I just decided that on my tombstone shall be these words: when I am dead and gone, may it be said, his sins were scarlet, but his books were red. That's not original. I should be Scotch. You know the joke, the Irishman and the Englishman on the train arguing about whether you say neither or neither, and the Scotchman solved it. It's neither. In the words of that incredibly eloquent singing group we just heard a few moments ago, there are three things that shall never die: truth and goodness and beauty. These are the three things we all need, and need absolutely, and know we need, and know we need absolutely. Our minds want not only some truth and some falsehood, but all truth without limit. Our wills want not only some good and some evil, but all good without limit. Our desires, imaginations, sensibility, feelings, or hearts want not some beauty and some ugliness, but all beauty without limit. For these are the only three things we never get bored with, and never will for all eternity, because they are three attributes of God, and therefore of all God's creation, three transcendental or absolutely universal properties of all reality. All that exists is true, the proper object of mind. All that exists is good, the proper object of will. All that exists is beautiful, the proper object of the heart, or feelings, or desires, or sensibility, or imagination. This third area is much more difficult to define than the first two. Every culture seeks these three things too, for man makes culture before culture makes man. A sidebar here, I use the word man inclusively rather than exclusively. I hope you Brits, you inventors and custodians of the English language, will permit me to use standard English instead of the current American politically correct ideologically imposed feminazisms. Some cultures, however, like some individuals, specialize in one of the three transcendentals. In the Orient, India has specialized in the love of truth, of ultimate mystical and metaphysical truth. China has specialized in the love of the good, the practical human good, whether Confucian or Taoist or even communist. And Japan has specialized in the love of beauty, especially the beauty of the arts. In the modern West, German culture, as distinct from German politics, has specialized in truth, especially philosophical and scientific truth. American culture in the practical human good, and English culture in beauty. Small islands like Japan and England seem to resonate especially to the love of beauty, perhaps because of the sea, and perhaps because of the appreciation of limits. God revealed these three attributes of his nature to all mankind: truth, especially through the philosophers, good, especially through the prophets and moralists, and beauty through the poets, artists, musicians, and mythmakers. He chose the Jewish people, especially Moses and the prophets, to be revealers of the infallible law of goodness. But many of the fathers of the church saw the Greek philosophers as fallible but also divinely inspired searchers for the truth, the word, the logos, who in Christ incarnated and fulfilled the Greek as well as the Jewish messianic hopes. The two greatest Christian writers and thinkers of the 20th century completed this scheme by seeing ancient pagan mythology in the same messianic way, in the more obscure area of the human heart that responds to beauty. G.K. Chesterton in The Everlasting Man and C.S. Lewis in the essay Myth Become Fact and in the books Till We Have Faces and Perelandra. Lewis calls pagan myths gleams of celestial strength and beauty falling on jungles of filth and imbecility because they are based on a solider reality than we dream, but are an almost infinite distance removed from their base. God has not left himself without witness in any of the three distinctively human, more than animal, powers of the soul, the three aspects of the image of God in us: The mind, which knows and understands the good, the will, which chooses and enforces it, and the emotions, which love and appreciate it. This threefold structure of the soul is also the reason why so many great classics in our literature have three protagonists, corresponding to these three psychological faculties and social functions: prophet, king, and priest. For instance, Gandalf, Aragorn, and Frodo. Ivan, Dmitri, and Alyosha Karamazov. Mr. Spock, Captain Kirk, and Bones McCoy. And not only fictional trios, within Christ's inner circle, we find St. John, the philosophical mystic, St. Peter, the rock, the leader, and St. James, the practical psychologist. The starship Soul, like the starship Enterprise, needs a science officer, a captain, and a doctor. Every ship needs a knowledge of where she is going, the will and command to go there, and the sailor's work of bringing her there. Aristotle similarly divided up all human sciences into theoretical, practical, and productive. In Plato's terms, we are reason, spirited part, and appetite, the inner basis for his natural division of society into philosophers, warriors, and producers. In Freud's terms, we are superego, ego, and id. We are head, hands, and heart. We respond to truth, goodness, and beauty. We are this because we are images of God. Each of us is one person with three distinct powers. God is one God, but with three distinct persons. The Son, the Logos, is the mind of the Father and performs his good will in redeeming the world. The Spirit is the poet. He composes and choreographs the operatic love between the Father and the Son in both creating and redeeming, and thus he is the sanctifier. The Spirit is the saint maker, and the saint is the most beautiful thing on earth. As the Spirit proceeds from Father and Son, children proceed from husband and wife, the holy family on earth manifesting the holy Trinitarian family of heaven, though very imperfectly and obscurely, through a glass darkly. And as the Son, though equal to the Father in all things, willingly and lovingly submits to the Father's loving goodwill, the loving wife lovingly submits to her loving husband's loving goodwill, though she is equal to him in all things. For this is not politics, but music. Not equality, but harmony. Not justice, but love. The order of these three transcendentals of truth, goodness, and beauty is ontologically founded. Truth is defined by being, for truth is the effulgence of being, the revelation of being, the word of being. Truth is not defined by consciousness, which conforms to being in knowing it. Goodness is defined by truth, not by will, which is good when it conforms to the truth of being. And beauty is defined by goodness, objectively, real goodness, not by subjective desire or pleasure or feeling or imagination, all of which should conform to it. The Madonna really is beautiful. Madonna really is ugly. It's amazing how a single definite article can differentiate a saint from a slut. However, the psychological order is the reverse of the ontological order. As we know being through first sensing appearances, so we are attracted to goodness first by its beauty. We are attracted to truth by its goodness, and we are attracted to being by its truth. But ontologically, truth depends on being, goodness on truth, and beauty on goodness. Truth is knowing being. Goodness is true goodness, and the most beautiful thing in the world is perfect goodness. That is why the most beautiful movie ever made was also the bloodiest one, The Passion of the Christ. According to Aquinas, beauty is id quod videtur placet, that which being seen pleases. Though beauty is derivative from truth and goodness, it has the greatest power over our souls. This is why most addictions come from something that appears beautiful, whether Gollum's ring, a false precious, or a drug or alcohol high, which is a false mystical experience, or a false love that apes married love but lacks its truth. And therefore, the only effective cure for addiction must come from something that appears even more beautiful than the addiction. As Aquinas says, the only thing strong enough to overcome an evil passion is a more powerful good passion. The beauty of a sober saint, to which the alcoholic aspires, is a powerful cure for alcoholism. The beauty of the bloody love of Christ can overcome the beauty of the forbidden love of a beautiful body. Augustine, in his soliloquies, imagines God asking him, "What do you want to know?" And Augustine replies, "Only two things, yourself and myself." That is not narrow. That is broad. For a self or person involves all three of the things we need and want infinitely: truth, goodness, and beauty. So there really are six things we want to know in knowing these two. But the six are really three, since our three are reflections of God's three. Now, who can tell us more than C.S. Lewis about all three things, the only things we need to know? Not many. Hardly any other writer had more strings to his bow than Lewis. Can you think of one who excels him in all three areas, who is more intelligent and reveals more truth, and more saintly and reveals more goodness, and more creative and writes more beautifully and stimulates more deep feelings in the reader? I know of no one since Augustine. When I began to summarize and order Lewis's wisdom about each of these three transcendentals, I discovered that all three of them follow the same order. In all three, Lewis shows us seven things. First, their logic, or definition. Second, their metaphysics, their objective reality. Third, their theology, their divine source. Fourth, their epistemology, how we know them. Fifth, their practical psychology. Sixth, their axiology, or value, the ordered relationship of these three values. And seventh, their mystical eschatology, their fulfillment in heaven. I do not apologize for quoting Lewis every other sentence for the rest of this paper. No paper on Lewis has ever been better than Lewis. It's not usually our originality, but our pride and our false beliefs about originality that prevent us from quoting Lewis more. First, the logic, Lewis's definitions of truth, goodness, and beauty. Lewis defines truth as Aristotle and common sense do, as correspondence with reality. In Myth Become Fact, he says, truth is always about something, and reality is that about which truth is. This is denied by the most insane philosophy in the history of human thought, deconstructionism. We all know what truth means, even though we argue about which ideas have truth. What is truth is really the easiest question of all in philosophy. Pilate was an imbecile, or perhaps a deconstructionist. We also all know what goodness is. We all know the goodness of goodness and the badness of badness. We even know, by nature, God's goodness. As Lewis says in The Problem of Pain, the divine goodness differs from ours not as white differs from black, but as a perfect circle from a child's first attempt to draw a wheel. In A Grief Observed, Lewis rejects what he calls the extreme Calvinism of the idea that we are so depraved that our ideas of goodness must count for nothing, by pointing out that if that were true, then we would have no motive for obeying God. At the same time, in The Problem of Pain, Lewis defines goodness relative to God, not God relative to goodness. He writes, "The proper good of a creature is to surrender itself to its creator, to enact intellectually, volitionally, and emotionally," the three transcendentals, "that relationship which is given in the mere fact of its being a creature." So, goodness, like truth, is relative to reality. I think the most fundamental and universal of all moral principles is what I call the 3R principle, right response to reality. I can't resist quoting the rest of Lewis's paragraph simply because it's high and holy theology, and though well known, easily forgotten from The Problem of Pain. He says, "Lest we should think this surrender a hardship, it begins on a level far above the creatures, for God himself, as Son, from all eternity, renders back to God as Father by filial obedience the being which the Father, by paternal love, eternally generates in the Son. This is the pattern which man was made to imitate, which paradisal man did imitate. And wherever the will conferred by the Creator is thus perfectly offered back in delighted and delighting obedience by the creature, there most undoubtedly is heaven, and there the Holy Ghost proceeds. I think it was truly said, Lewis goes on to say, God loveth not himself, but as goodness. And if there were aught better than God, he would love that and not himself. From the highest to the lowest, self exists to be abdicated, and by that abdication become the more truly self, to be thereupon yet the more abdicated, and so forever. This is not a heavenly law which we can escape by remaining earthly, nor an earthly law which we can escape by being saved. What is outside the system of self-giving is not earth, nor nature, nor ordinary life, but simply and solely hell. A high and holy definition of goodness, and a mystical one. And we are getting ahead of our outline into theology and eschatology. The definition of beauty, like beauty itself, is more obscure and mysterious than either truth or goodness. But our perception of it is just as sharp and certain, and as objective, as Lewis shows in The Abolition of Man by the example of Coleridge and the two tourists at the waterfall. Our second point is the metaphysics of truth, goodness, and beauty, that is, their objective reality. Lewis's polemic against the deniers of objective truth, goodness, and beauty is wonderfully simple and powerful. In the essay De Futilitate, he says, if our minds are totally alien to reality, then all our thoughts, including this thought, are worthless. So this shows the immediate self-contradiction of both the old-fashioned skeptical scientific materialist and the newfangled postmodernist subjectivist relativist. The old kind of skeptic forbids us to claim that any idea is true or good or beautiful. The new kind forbids us to claim that any idea is false or evil or ugly. I call it the tyranny of tolerance. The Pope called it the absolutism of relativism. De Tocqueville called it soft totalitarianism. It is almost as dangerous as a Ouija board. Lewis's polemic against both of these denials of our knowledge of objective truth, goodness, and beauty is simply to let his opponents talk, to give them rope and watch them hang themselves, like Sauron. Look at that parallel. Sauron's ring of power is self-destructive. The War of the Ring is won not by superior power, but by weakness, by renunciation of power, by hobbits. That's how God defeated Satan. He became a little hobbit. This simple point that truth, goodness, and beauty are objectively real is liberating. It liberates us from many silly questions and wastes of time. For instance, Lewis says in Letters to Malcolm, what makes some theological works like sawdust to me is the way the authors can go on discussing how far certain positions are adjustable to contemporary thought or beneficial in relation to social problems or have a future before them, but never squarely ask what grounds we have for supposing them to be true, as if we were trying to make rather than learn. Have we no other to reckon with? Well, not if we're dreaming, or if we're pantheists, or if we're in hell. If intellectual subjectivism is self-contradictory and even insanity and perhaps even dishonesty, what could be worse? Moral subjectivism, which Lewis says in The Poison of Subjectivism, is a disease that will certainly end our species and damn our souls if it is not crushed. Please remember that in contrast to American fundamentalist preachers, Oxford dons are not prone to exaggeration. Lewis's argument proves two things. Negatively, that intellectual and moral and also aesthetic skepticism and subjectivism are false because they are self-contradictory, and positively, that therefore their opposites are true. Thus he concludes, quote, we must grant logic to reality. We must, if we are to have any moral standards, grant it moral standards too, and there is really no reason why we should not do the same about standards of beauty. Third comes the theology of goodness, truth, and beauty, the ultimate source. All three of the transcendentals are not abstract ideals. They are concrete facts, like the softness of my skin or the selfishness of my soul, because they are attributes of God, the supremely concrete reality. They are, so to speak, what God is made of. First, as Arthur Holmes has eloquently said, all truth is God's truth. In Reflections on the Psalms, Lewis writes, whatever was true in Akhenaten's creed came to him in some mode or other, as all truth comes to men, from God. In Surprised by Joy, he says, I think that all things in their way reflect heavenly truth, the imagination not the least. Chapter 5 of Miracles offers the same argument about our ideas of goodness as Chapter 3 offers about our ideas of truth. He concludes, as the argument in the previous chapter led us to acknowledge a supernatural source for rational thought, so the argument of this leads us to acknowledge a supernatural source for our ideas of good and evil. And not just for our ideas of goodness, but for our actual goodness. For as Lewis says in Mere Christianity, Christians think any good they do comes from the Christ life inside them. In The Four Loves, he writes, we were made for God, only by being in some respect like him, only by being a manifestation of his beauty and loving kindness and wisdom and goodness, has any earthly beloved ever excited our love. That is, of course, the Augustinian wisdom. Thou hast made us for thyself, and therefore our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. But then Lewis goes on to correct or improve Augustine's definition of evil as loving creatures too much or with disordered love, when he writes, it is not that we have loved them too much, but that we did not quite understand what we were loving. It is not that we shall be asked to turn from them, so dearly familiar, to a stranger. When we see the face of God, we shall know that we have always known it. In A Grief Observed, Lewis says of his wife's beauty, of her and of every created thing I praise, I should say, in some way, in its unique way, it is like him who made it. Our fourth category is the epistemology of truth, goodness, and beauty, how we know them. We know all three transcendentals immediately and intuitively, not by inference or argument. Even truth. Lewis writes, you cannot produce rational intuition of truth by argument, because all argument depends on rational intuition. This rational intuition is literally indubitable or self-evident. Lewis describes it as that which no honest man has ever dreamed of doubting. For instance, no one has ever imagined, much less written, a story, even a bad one, about a world in which the law of non-contradiction was untrue. We also directly know moral goodness. In The Problem of Pain, Lewis says, the experiences expressed by the words I ought or I ought not cannot be logically deduced. The consciousness of a moral law at once approved and disobeyed is neither a logical nor an illogical inference from the facts of experience. If we did not bring it to our experience, we could not find it there. It is either inexplicable illusion or else direct revelation. Beauty is also experienced directly and immediately, as Lewis describes his early childhood experience of Squirrel Nutkin and later of Norse mythology and Wagner's music. When we speak of religion rather than theology, that is about the relation between ourselves and God rather than about the eternal essence of God, aesthetics proves to be more, not less, adequate than intellectual or moral analogies. In Letters to Malcolm, Lewis explains why the analogy of the artist is more revealing of God's way with the world than either the analogy of God the scientist or philosopher, who thinks in abstractions and generalizations, or the analogy of the king or political ruler who rules by causality. He says, how could the creator work by general laws? To generalize is to be a finite mind. And he also says, strictly causal thinking is inadequate when applied to the relation between God and man. It has led to the whole puzzle about grace and free will. But he also says, surely a man of genius composing a poem or a symphony must be less unlike God than a ruler. The course of events on earth is not governed like a state. It is created like a work of art. From God's point of view, the act of creation is going on right now. Fifth, some practical psychology. If goodness, truth, and beauty are all objective, then we can err about them. If not, not. If we can err, how do we avoid error? What practical tools or clues does Lewis offer for attaining these three greatest things in the world? Concerning truth, first, in the essay Religion, Reality, or Substitute, Lewis repeats the answer that was well known since Aristotle, especially in the Middle Ages, and forgotten or denied only in the 20th century. Authority, reason, experience. On these three, mixed in varying proportions, all our knowledge depends. Lewis is very often original by not trying to be original. In an age which has jettisoned all of its tradition, the only rebellion possible is orthodoxy. The most popular answer in our day to the question of how you know the truth, at least among so-called educated people in our so-called universities, is feeling. Our guru is really Rousseau, one of history's greatest hypocrites. I would trust Machiavelli before I would trust Rousseau. Lewis demolishes this answer that we know truth by feeling very simply. He writes, the value given to the testimony of any feeling must depend on our whole philosophy, not our whole philosophy on a feeling. Of these three ways of knowing, experience, reason, and authority, we're talking about knowing now, authority has become the dreaded word. But Lewis points out that, quote, I go to authority because reason sends me to it. One of the things my reason tells me is that I ought to check the results of my own thinking by the opinions of the wise. Experience counts too, but not any and all experience equally, but especially spiritual experience, and especially by spiritual and wise experiencers. Both in miracles and in the problem of pain, Lewis quotes John 7:17, he who does the will of the Father shall know the doctrine. That is, there are personal and moral qualifications for knowing the truth. The primary moral qualification is honesty. And therefore, this is the primary virtue Screwtape fears and attacks. It is the one mentioned most often in the Screwtape letters. Screwtape writes to his apprentice devil, the great thing is to make your patient value an opinion for some quality other than truth. And this is the primary virtue Lewis demands. For instance, in Man or Rabbit, which is the one essay I think Lewis would pick if he could pick just one thing he has ever written and force every single person in modern Western civilization to read. This essay reminds me of Pascal's Pensées on diversion. And therefore, I cannot resist shooting a few of its sentences like arrows at your heart. The question of the essay is, can't you lead a good life without believing in Christianity? And Lewis immediately challenges the question instead of answering it, just as Jesus almost always does. He writes, this is the question on which I have been asked to write, and straight away, before I begin trying to answer it, I have a comment to make. The question sounds as if it were asked by a person who said to himself, I don't care whether Christianity is in fact true or not. I'm going to choose beliefs not because I think them true, but because I find them helpful. Now, frankly, I find it hard to sympathize with this state of mind. One of the things that distinguishes man from the other animals is that he wants to know things, wants to find out what reality is like, simply for the sake of knowing. When that desire is completely quenched in anyone, I think he has become something less than human. That man is shirking. He is deliberately trying not to know whether Christianity is true or false because he foresees endless trouble if it should be turned out to be true. He is like the man who won't go to the doctor when he first feels a mysterious pain because he is afraid of what the doctor may tell him. The man who remains an unbeliever for such reasons is not in a state of honest error. He is in a state of dishonest error, And that dishonesty will spread through all his thoughts and actions. A certain shiftiness, a vague worry in the background, a blunting of his whole mental edge will result. He has lost his intellectual virginity, and probably the other kind too. Lewis's greatest compliment to his wife, in A Grief Observed, is that she wanted truth at any price. One of the truest clues, if we are honest, to finding the most important truths is surprise. The real world is strange, not simple. And if we are full of pride and prejudice, we will not explore the bushes where the best game hides. For instance, we will not investigate the puzzling, repellent, or difficult passages in Scripture, as Lewis does so wonderfully in The Weight of Glory. Nor will we marry women like Joy Davidman, who was gloriously other than Lewis, and not what he called one of his bachelor pipe dreams. This, by the way, I think, is the reason God disapproves of masturbation, both physical and mental, that is, philosophical subjectivism, and spiritual, that is, pop psychology and New Age pantheism. They are all autoerotic, rather than open to otherness. Thus, they are not preparations for heaven. In his apologetics, Lewis constantly turns difficulties into advantages, objections into arguments pro. For, as he says in The Problem of Pain, if any message from the core of reality were to reach us, we should expect to find in it just that unexpectedness, that willful, dramatic anfractuosity which we find in the Christian faith. The taste of reality, not made by us, but hitting us in the face. Like modern science, as distinct from modern scientism or ideology. Lewis also says in Mere Christianity, it's no good asking for a simple religion. After all, real things are not simple. And besides being complicated, reality is usually very odd. It is not neat, not obvious, not what you expect. That is one of the reasons I believe Christianity. It is a religion you could not have guessed. It is not the sort of thing anyone would have made up. By the way, that is also a very old apologetic argument. We find it in Tertullian, who said, I believe because it is absurd. We find it in Kierkegaard, who called the incarnation the absolute paradox. We find it in Dostoevsky. It is Ivan Karamazov's reason for questioning his atheism. The psychology of knowing the good is easier than the psychology of knowing the true, because God has left much more knowledge of moral goodness innate in fallen man's soul than he has left innate knowledge of theological truth. And that is why the world's religions differ radically about theology, but not about morality. It takes divine revelation to give us knowledge of God, but it takes only personal, natural, human honesty to give us knowledge of God's will, of moral goodness. It's a need-to-know thing. Lewis explains in Mere Christianity that there is one qualification for knowing good, being good. He says, when a man is getting better, he understands more and more clearly the evil that is still left in him. When a man is getting worse, he understands his own badness less and less. You understand sleep when you are awake, not when you are sleeping. Drunkenness when you are sober. As the knowledge of goodness is more natural, more innate, more universal, and more simple than the knowledge of truth, so the knowledge of beauty is even more natural, innate, universal, and easy. We all experience something that moves our heart to wonder, to joy, to something like Sehnsucht, whether it is Squirrel Nutkin or the Lord of the Rings, whether it is Wagner or Gregorian chant. The beauty of God is even experienced through our bodies, as Lewis says in Letters to Malcolm, but for the body, one whole realm of God's glory, all that we receive through the senses, would go unpraised. For the beasts can't appreciate it, and the angels are pure intelligences. The beauties of nature are a secret God has shared with us alone. That may be one of the reasons why we were made, and why the resurrection of the body is an important doctrine. Sixth, the value theory, or axiology, of truth, goodness, and beauty, the relations between these three values, has some strange similarities to the doctrine of the circumincession of the three persons of the Trinity. The ontological order flows from being to truth, truth to goodness, and goodness to beauty. That is, truth is judged by being, goodness by truth, and beauty by goodness. Whereas the psychological order of our experiencing of them is the reverse. We are moved to goodness by its beauty, to truth by its goodness, and to being by its truth. The three main points I find Lewis making here are, first, that beauty is not the absolute, but points beyond itself. Second, that the goodness which transcends beauty is still dependent on truth. And third, that truth is absolute only if it is the truth of being. In First and Second Things, Lewis notes that beauty withers when we worship it as the absolute. The point of that very simple and practical article is, if you put first things first and second things second, both flourish. Put second things first and first things second, and not only do you lose the first things, but also the second. Art for art's sake is not only idolatry, but fatal to art. Though art for money's sake or fame's sake is even worse. Put good above beauty, and beauty flourishes. This does not mean moralism or allegory. It means following the pointing finger of beauty, looking along it rather than just at it, as Lewis learned to do in Surprised by Joy, that wonderful distinction between looking at and looking along in the little essay Meditation in a Tool Shed is really the key to the psychology of Surprised by Joy. Lewis shocks us psychologistic moderns, us feeling fondlers, by writing, as do all the saints, that feelings, the powers by which we become aware of and attracted by beauty, are irrelevant and unimportant to moral goodness. He says, it is by his will alone that a man is good or bad. Feelings by themselves are not of any importance. That is shocking to us. It was not shocking to any of our ancestors. On the other hand, Lewis disagrees with Kant. Moral duty is not duty for duty's sake. It leads yonder, taking beauty and joy with it. Thus, all the saints are full of joy, not full of dour duty. It is one-year-olds in toilet training who must learn to do their duty. In one of his letters, Lewis writes, a perfect man would never act from a sense of duty. He'd always want the right thing more than the wrong one. Lewis also says, duty exists to be transcended. There is no morality in heaven. The road to the promised land leads past Mount Sinai. And in The Problem of Pain, the more virtuous a man becomes, the more he enjoys virtuous actions. The Catholic Church will not canonize a saint unless she finds in his life all the fruits of the Spirit, one of which is joy. A dour saint is an oxymoron. Even Jerome had a sense of humor. When goodness flourishes, so does beauty. The most beautiful thing in the world is a saint, and the most powerful argument. No one can resist Mother Teresa, unless she works as a columnist for the Times. You know who I'm thinking of. Lewis wrote in Letters to an American Lady, holiness is irresistible. If even 10% of the world's population had it, the whole world would be converted and happy before the year's end. I think that is literally true. Holiness is not an abstraction. It is not even a concrete but plural goodness, traceable back to many men, but all comes from one. Goodness means ultimately Christ himself, the most beautiful sight human eyes have ever beheld, and the bloodiest, since in Christ's day there were also many who worked as columnists for the Times. The meaning of the word good is ultimately the word of God, Christ. As Lewis put it in Mere Christianity, all true goodness is a kind of good infection from Christ, known or unknown, as he was unknown to Emeth in the last battle. When he describes this good infection, Lewis is very realistic. He says, the New Testament is always talking about putting on Christ, about Christ being formed in us, about our coming to have the mind of Christ. Please put out of your mind the idea that these are only fancy ways of saying that Christians are to read what Christ said and try to carry it out, as a man may read what Plato or Marx said and try to carry it out. They mean something much more than that. They mean that a real person, Christ, here and now, in that very room where you are saying your prayers, is doing things to you, really coming and interfering with your very self, killing the old self in you and replacing it with the kind of self he has. Lewis is wonderfully scary. As in the end of chapter 11 of Miracles, there comes a moment when the children who have been playing at burglars hush suddenly. Was that a real footstep in the hall? There comes a moment when people who have been dabbling in religion, man's search for God, suddenly draw back. Supposing we really found him, we never meant it to come to that. Elsewhere, Lewis describes man's search for God as the mouse's search for the cat. Truth, if we are honest, must transcend all forms of beauty, including what we like and what comforts us. Thus, Lewis says in Mere Christianity, comfort is the one thing you cannot get by looking for it. If you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth, only wishful thinking to begin with, and in the end, despair. It's the principle of first and second things again. In the preface to Mere Christianity, Lewis addresses the question of choosing which Christian church or denomination to join, since Mere Christianity is not a church or denomination. It is not a door into a living room, but only a hallway. And his answer is, above all, you must be asking which door is the true one, not which pleases you best. Truth transcends not only the beauty of comfort or pleasure, but also goodness of motive. In Bulverism, Lewis argues that we cannot prove that Christianity or any other truth claim is false or true by showing that the motives someone has for believing it are morally bad or good. You must first prove a belief is false before explaining it away by impugning the motives for believing the error. Our last point is also the most exciting because it is the most heavenly and mystical, the eschatology, the future consummation of our experience of truth, goodness, and beauty. First, truth. Truth will become concrete rather than abstract. We will see it with our eyes. We will eat it and drink it with our bodies. In fact, we can already do this. For truth became concrete in Christ, who said, I am the truth. And as St. John testified in awe and wonder at the beginning of his first epistle, this eternal word of life we saw with our eyes, we touched, we handled. We also eat truth and drink truth when we eat his body and drink his blood. We can argue and theologize and split the church and fight religious wars over the right understanding of this, if we will like, as we have done in the past. Or we can listen to Lewis when he says, our Lord did not say, take and understand. He said, take and eat. In The Great Divorce, chapter 5, the bright spirit says to the modern relativist theologian, hitherto you have experienced truth only with the abstract intellect. I will bring you where you can taste it like honey and be embraced by it as by a bridegroom. St. Thomas Aquinas, certainly no crude, materialistic, or unsophisticated fundamentalist theologian, says that in heaven we will see the face of God with our own eyes as we now see the happiness in a friend's face. Neither God, nor happiness, nor truth are bodies like animals or atoms, but all three are bodied forth to us humans, that is, to human embodied souls. Goodness will also be transfigured, but only after it is faced. As Lewis says in The Problem of Pain, the moral law exists to be transcended, but there is no transcending it for those who have not first admitted its claims upon them and then tried with all their strength to meet that claim and then fairly and squarely faced the fact of their failure. He tells us in Letters to Malcolm, if we were perfected, prayer would not be a duty. It would be a delight. Someday, please God, it will be. If I loved my neighbor as myself, most of the actions which are now my moral duty would flow from me as spontaneously as a song from a lark or fragrance from a flower. Why is this not so yet? Well, we know, don't we? In Mere Christianity, Lewis writes, though Christianity seems at first to be all about morality, all about duties and rules and guilt and virtue, yet it leads you on out of all that into something beyond. One has a glimpse of a country where they do not talk of those things except perhaps as a joke. Everyone there is filled full of what we should call goodness, as a mirror is filled with light, but they do not call it goodness. They do not call it anything. They are not thinking of it. They are too busy looking at the source from which it comes. In those very simple sentences, we have some very high mystical theology. There is no morality in heaven, and Man or Rabbit tells us a little bit about why and what replaces it. Lewis says, mere morality is not the end of life. The people who keep on asking if they can't lead a decent life without Christ don't know what life is about. If they did, they would know that a decent life is mere machinery compared with the thing we are really made for. Morality is indispensable, but the divine life, which gives itself to us and which calls us to be gods, intends for us something in which morality will be swallowed up. We are to be remade. All the rabbit in us is to disappear. The worried, conscientious, ethical rabbit, as well as the cowardly and sensual rabbit. We shall bleed and squeal as the handfuls of fur come out. And then, surprisingly, we shall find, underneath it all, a thing we have never yet imagined. A real man, an ageless God, a son of God, strong, radiant, wise, beautiful, and drenched in joy. This is the weight of glory, which Lewis describes in the most unforgettable paragraph he ever wrote. The weight of my neighbor's glory should be laid daily on my back, a load so heavy that only humility can carry it, and the backs of the proud will be broken. It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of these destinations. What, then, finally, of beauty's eschatology? We know very little, even if we are mystics. Lewis says in Miracles, spirit and nature have quarreled in us. That is our disease. Nothing we can yet do enables us to imagine its complete healing. Some glimpses and faint hints we have in the sacraments, in the use made of sensuous imagery by the great poets, in the best instances of sexual love, in our experiences of the earth's beauty. But the full healing is utterly beyond our present conception. Mystics have got as far in contemplation of God as the point at which the senses are banished. The farther point at which they will be put back again has, to the best of my knowledge, been reached by no one. We do not want merely to see beauty, he says in that golden sermon, though God knows even that is bounty enough. We want something else, which can hardly be put into words, to be united with the beauty we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become part of it. At present, we are on the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of the morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors we see. But all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. Someday, God willing, we shall get in. We are summoned to pass in through nature, beyond her, into that splendor which she fitfully reflects. The faint, far-off results of those energies which God's creative rapture implanted in matter when he made the worlds are what we now call physical pleasures. And even thus filtered, they are too much for our present management. What would it be like to taste at the fountainhead that stream of which even these lower reaches prove so intoxicating? Yet that, I believe, is what lies before us. The whole man is to drink joy from the fountain of joy. The fountain of joy, what's that? Nothing less than God himself. We are to eat and drink God's truth, goodness, and beauty, in eating and drinking God,
the host who gives himself without reserve to us, his guests, in the heavenly banquet where God is both the maker of the banquet and the food. And this heavenly banquet, this eschatological fullness, this pleroma or plenum, this infinite and incomprehensible ecstasy that will ravish our souls in all three of their godlike powers in ways that are now literally unimaginable, ways that will make us rightly regard as ridiculously trivial not only the most wild and wonderful paroxysms of sexual love that we have ever imagined or desired, much less experienced, but even the greatest mystics, greatest mystical ecstasies attainable in this world. This heavenly banquet is fully present and available for the taking to us now, here, though our appreciation of it is not. For it is nothing more or less than Christ himself, and he is really here. Behold, I am with you always. Who is here? The one who identified himself as the way, the truth, and the life. He is the way, the Tao, the good way, God's own goodwill. He is the truth, the Logos, the mind of God. And he is the life, the Zoe, the fire that is burning in the breast of all beauty. All beauty, even the most depraved. When the drunken drug addict buys a prostitute, he is really hunting and hungering for the beauty of God's kenosis, God's emptying, God's ecstatic standing outside himself on the cross, so that God can say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? God's total gift of himself to us, that beauty, the beauty of some infinitely gentle, infinitely suffering thing, in T.S. Eliot's unforgettable words. This is really present in the food we eat in the Eucharist, and it is really present in the souls and bodies of those who eat it. In both places, Christ is truly present and hidden, vere latitat. And this is where Lewis ends his golden sermon. Next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. If he is your Christian neighbor, he is holy in almost the same way. For in him, Christ, vere latitat, is truly hidden. Please turn and greet him there. And please don't ever stop. If you do only those two things, you will find the meaning of life, for the meaning of life is to be a saint, and a saint is one who knows and loves and eats truth and goodness and beauty. Thank you.
We do welcome questions, in part because we know that even as Christians from many traditions, we will agree and disagree about many things, and we want to be open, as Peter said, to otherness. It's also a chance to say that we seek to invite a variety of speakers, a diversity of speakers. This morning, in fact, we've had someone from the Russian Orthodox tradition, someone from the Anglican tradition, someone from the Catholic tradition, and someone from Texas.
Fourth religion.
John Dixon. So we invite a diversity of perspectives. We may disagree about Harry Potter or gender pronouns or Madonna, but what we really need to do is also find, amid our agreement and disagreement, the love of Christ for one another, which shows that we are his. So with that preface, if there are any questions for Peter, we welcome you to come forward. We'd have a few minutes.
The question is not, are there any questions? The question is, what are the questions? There will be questions.
Hi, I have one.
Yes.
First of all, thank you for sharing. My question is on morality. I'm sure probably in this room there would be a lot of agreement on, you know, as followers of Jesus Christ, a lot of agreement on what would be morality and how that would be defined, but there are probably many places where there would not be a standard of agreement on what morality is or how that would be defined. Do you think that morality is something that is divinely revealed to people?
I think morality is divinely revealed in the same way that beauty and truth are divinely revealed. I think they're revealed not only in the Bible and not only to faith. I think they're revealed every time you are honest with yourself and your experience in your world. That revelation, unlike the Bible, is not infallible, but it's divine revelation. It's a thing called conscience. Conscience is a prophet. God's inner prophet. I believe that there are some serious moral disagreements among serious Christians, but that 99% of the moral choices that any Christian has to make in his or her life are choices between clearly known good and clearly known evil, often rationalized, but pretty clearly known. I am not the president of the United States, so I don't have to worry about whether the war in Iraq should be chosen or not. It has been chosen. I don't know whether it's just or not. That's one of those questions that you're not directly responsible for. But how I treat my family and how I treat myself and my students and my time, that I am responsible for. And I know darn well what I do, good or bad, there.
The agreement on what morality is between a Christian and a non-Christian.
Yes, there's massive agreement on what morality is. Talk to a Muslim, and he will almost always say, there's only one religion, he says, and you Christians and we Muslims, we have the same religion, meaning the same theology and the same morality, and then he forgets about Jesus. But he's 99% right. What is good and what is evil? God reveals this in three ways. He reveals it through universal conscience to everyone. He reveals it in a special way through the Mosaic Law, which just reinforces conscience. And then he reveals it finally in the most perfect way in Christ. But as Lewis frequently points out, Christ did not invent a new morality. He was not a moral revolutionary. He was a reminder.
Dr. Kraft, as usual, thank you, thank you, thank you. I found it curious that Frederica Matthews Green this morning was talking about eating the light of God through the body and blood, and this idea of not merely apprehending intellectual ideas, but imbibing and becoming one with God. There's something obviously more three-dimensional about that than the idea of intellectual assent. And then Dr. McIntyre was talking about the importance of images and fiction and how that's different from mere philosophical statements. And then I was delighted to hear you say that you finished your novel, which I have had the privilege of hearing a little bit about from you. So my question is, would you please tell us about this novel?
I'll just read the title page for you.
Not the ending. Don't tell us.
Yeah. It's an angel's eye view of the connections between Jesus Christ, Muhammad, dead Vikings, sassy black feminists, Dutch Calvinist seminarians, large mother substitutes, armless nature mystics, Caribbean rubber dancers, Russian prophets, three popes in 1 year, Montezuma and Cortez, Romeo and Juliet, the wandering Jew, the sea serpent, the lily of the Mohawks, the lady of Guadalupe, the demon Huracano, Islam and the art of body surfing, the universal fate wave theory, the Palestinian Intifada, the fatal beauty of the sea, the incarnation of archetypal dreams, the dooms of the Boston Red Sox, abortion wars, the great blizzard of 78, the wisdom of the handicapped, the ecumenical jihad, the psychology of suicide, the identity crisis of the church, and the end of the world. But that gives it a spurious unity
if I may say, Gesundheit.
The perfect one-word review. You have just surpassed Samuel Johnson, who gave the best and shortest book review of all time. Dear sir, I have the book you sent me in front of me. I am sitting in the smallest room in my house. Soon I will have your book behind me.
You're sure you don't want to tell us about this novel in your own words?
No.
We have about 3 minutes, so again, if you could be economical,
serious questions.
That would be great.
Part of my question is a kind of a clarification. Just one of my big concerns is how to impart to the world. Well, you talked about truth, goodness, and beauty. And then you said the opposite is sort of the way that we, at least my interpretation, is the way that we really learn it. We can't start with the truth necessarily. We have these indicators. And my question is, most of the conversations that you have with people about truth, about religion, don't start with the beauty. But it seems like such a stronger foundation, a more common ground. I guess my question is, how do you propose when we go about in our conversations day to day with people? Do we veer them? Well, before I tell you about, you know, before we argue about moral relativism here, let me draw your attention to this. Or is it something that where you just like try to answer every single question? That's where I'm kind of stuck.
Insofar as we have to ask that question, we're not answering it. Insofar as we think about method, we're not doing it.
Okay.
Insofar as you think about what notes you're playing, you're not playing them. total self-forgetfulness, total honesty, and total love is the most effective apologetic.
I think this gentleman was first, and then we'll end with this question.
Thank you so much for this wonderful presentation. I'm interested in what you might say, or C.S. Lewis might say, or has said, if you can encapsulate it, about the how of the holiness. What did he have to say about this purity? We've talked about the what, but what did he have to say about the mechanisms, whether it's on the mystical side, whether it's on the experiential side, or probably all of it, but what would be the two or three key things that he would say that a person must do?
I would give you exactly the same answer I gave the previous questioner. Insofar as we're concentrating on the how, we're concentrating on ourselves. There are times we have to do that. We have to take our temperature when we have a fever. We have to occasionally scrutinize our own conscience and our own motives. But surely to make that the staple of our lives is to be a spiritual hypochondriac and to get ingrown eyeballs. And the more you are simply in the presence of God, the more you are ravished by His beauty, and all those problems are not solved but dissolved. One of my favorite spiritual classics is a very, very simple one. It's Brother Lawrence's Practice of the Presence of God.
Just a quick question. I don't know how to ask it. When you said the Madonna is beautiful and Madonna is ugly, my subjective reaction was very sad as we clapped at that statement.
Cheap shot.
Well, and I guess just can you expand on the balance between, you know, what she's done to misuse and twist her sexuality into a manipulative tool to advance herself, but then how...
But I don't want to. I see no reason for it. What you do with such things is you flush the toilet, and
okay.
You turn to beautiful
but
things.
But then how she is an image bearer of God, and how she is a possible god and goddess as well.
The worst thing about sin is that in order to sin, you have to make God sin, because God's image lives in you. And if you're a Christian, his very life lives in you, and you use that power in a twisted way, all sin is blasphemy. So once again, if you realize the presence of God, that's a very powerful deterrent to sin.
Thank you.
Let's thank Dr. Kraft again for the morning.